All right, so Daniel chapter 5 is one of the most dramatic stories in all of humanity. It just is such a great story. We're so glad to be at this text today, and there's such a lot to learn from it. All great stories really come from the Bible. The Bible has the best storylines ever. A little bit like the storyline in Daniel chapter 5 is the story of the Titanic. April 14, 1912, at 11:40 p.m., the Titanic struck the iceberg. Dr. Washington Dodge was on board, and he was one of the survivors. And he said, "None of us had the slightest realization that the ship had received its death wound. Captain Smith said there was no danger. As the lifeboats were being launched, many of the first cabin passengers expressed their preference of staying on the ship. The passengers were constantly being assured that there was no danger, but that as a matter of extra precaution, the women and children should be placed in the lifeboats. One Irish fellow, who was also among the survivors and a musician, he said, 'I played the pipes and there was a great deal of dancing and singing. This was kept up even after we had struck the iceberg, for the stewards came through and told us that we need not be afraid, that everything was all right. There was no danger, they said.' And most of those assembled believed them until it was too late." And really, that's sort of like a picture of all the human condition. We always think that everything's okay, and then all of a sudden, it's too late. And what we need is for God to interrupt our leisure, to interrupt our party and tell us, hey, there is accountability. There is heaven. There is hell. And we have to bring that into focus. So today, this wonderful storyline in Daniel chapter 5, what we're going to see is King Belshazzar's, in the first place, his defiance of all that is good. He's just defiant. He doesn't care. And then we're going to see his first oh no moments when finally the truth begins to dawn on him that he's in big trouble. And then we're going to see his desperate reach for some shred of hope. Is there no hope? Can we still somehow salvage this? And then we're going to see his realization too late that he had come to the end of the line. And all of that then is going to have a great lesson for us on accountability before God. All right, so we start with Belshazzar the king and his defiance, his brazen defiance against all that is good. So chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the gold and silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines might drink in them. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and they praised the gods of gold and of silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So here we are in an alcohol-fueled pagan celebration of decadence. We see that this is an intentional display of disrespect to the true God. So, you know, why bring the vessels from the temple of God out of storage for this occasion? It's because we conquered Jerusalem some time back. The God of Jerusalem could not defend his own temple. We are stronger than the God of Jerusalem. And let's bring those gold and silver vessels and remind everybody that the God of Jerusalem is little. And we, the Babylonians, because of our evil spirits, are grand. And so let's just make a point of celebrating that right now. And so this is an intentional display of disrespect to God. Furthermore, it was a further pledge to the evil spirits who made Babylon great. And the king and his 1,000 guests were going to say to the world, including the evil spirits, our spirits are greater than the God of Jerusalem. We love our spirits and we pledge further loyalty to them. And so we praise the gods of gold and silver and bronze and wood and iron. Now, all this bluster is taking place while the Persians are outside the city ready to attack. But they don't care because they think that Babylon is bulletproof. It's a little bit like, again, the Titanic. Frank Prentice, 23 years old, was one of the survivors. He says, there were two reasons why many were reluctant to get in the lifeboats. First, it was a 70-foot drop into the water. So it's a little scary to be hovering in a lifeboat over 70 feet of space. He says, and second, they never thought the ship would actually sink. So you see, there's just this brazen defiance until it's too late. Archibald Gracie said, "When the vessel struck, the passengers were so little alarmed that they joked over the matter. The few that were on deck early had taken their time to dress properly, and there was not the slightest indication of panic. Some of the fragments of ice from the iceberg had fallen on the deck of the ship, and these were picked up and passed around by some of the facetious ones who offered them as mementos of the occasion. So look here, you have a souvenir from the iceberg that we hit. The ship was going to be underwater in 2.5 hours, but they didn't know. And Edith Russell, she was 33 years old, and she was on the top deck and also playing with those little fragments of iceberg. She said, there was a very slight bump, just a little jar, nothing at all. We thought nothing of it. We picked up the bits of ice, and most of us played snowballs. The ship is going to go under, and most are going to die in 2.5 hours. But they don't know. Here is Belshazzar, and he is having a feast while the Persians are amassing outside the walls of Babylon. But he doesn't care. He doesn't think anything of it. As a matter of fact, he's having a big party celebration of how mighty his Babylonian gods are and why Babylon could never fall to the Persians who are outside the walls. As a historical note, this is really important, that there have always been people, you know, who hate the Bible and attack the Bible. And the Bible critics in the earlier 1800s talked about this story as a fable. They didn't want to deal with the realities of God's word. And they said, well, you know, this whole story is fake. And so, for example, skeptic Caesar von Lingerke, he described Daniel 5 that we're reading right now. He said, this is pure fiction, a palpable forgery. It was not written by anybody named Daniel, a palpable forgery, disfigured and falsified by the author, who was neither an eyewitness of the occurrences nor accurately acquainted with the history of them. So the guy who wrote it is not Daniel. Whoever did write it didn't really know the history of Babylon and Persia. And so it's all pure fiction, he said. But then in 1853, we found multiple cuneiform tablets in what we call today Iraq, in Ur. And King Nabonidus, who is known in history, was talking about his firstborn son, whose name was Belshazzar. Like, oops, well, I guess there is a Belshazzar. And then in 1924, that was the coup de grace in Babylon, Iraq, what we call Iraq today, we discovered another cuneiform document. So cuneiform is the wedge-shaped alphabet written in clay. And we call this the verse account of Nabonidus, who's Belshazzar's father. And it says here that Nabonidus entrusted the army to his oldest son, his firstborn. He entrusted the kingship to him and himself. He started out for a long journey. We think that Nabonidus was mentally ill. He left the kingdom to his son and went off, and he started doing very unusual things. He built another separate city out in the desert, and he was interested in a different god than the true God, or even the Babylonian gods. So everything was backwards and sideways, and we think he was mentally unwell. At any rate, he left the kingdom to his son, Belshazzar, his firstborn. And so we now know that this is not pure fiction. This is actual history. This is a true story. All right, so we find Belshazzar's first defiance of everything that's good. He's going to praise the evil spirits. He's going to demean the true God. And now we're going to come to the place in the story where he has his first oh no moment, when the truth begins to dawn on him that he's in big trouble. Chapter 5, verse 5. In the same hour, fingers of a man's hand came forth and wrote across the candlestick on the plaster of the wall. The candlestick, you know, they have a candelabra. And so in the light, they can see clearly that a hand, almost like the ghost hand, has begun to write a message. All right, in verse 6. Then the king's appearance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were made slack, and his knees struck against one another. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the fortune tellers. And the king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, whoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation of it shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold around his neck, shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Third, because Nabonidus' dad is out in the desert making another city and doing whatever he's doing. And then you have Belshazzar second under Dad, and the kingdom is left to him. And so Daniel could be, in this case, the third, not the second in the kingdom. That's all the king could offer. In verse 8, then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation of it. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled, and his appearance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Well, of course, every overtly supernatural experience we have in the world is breathtaking. And whenever God's holiness is involved, it is all the more breathtaking. This is something that has caused trouble. I am distressed. I am afraid. I am astonished. That's what's happening with everybody who sees it. Now, the problem is they could not read it. Even though there was a candlestick, they can see what was written on the plaster, but they didn't know how to read it. And the reason for that is, in the Hebrew language, or Aramaic in this case, which are almost the same, because it was hard. Imagine writing wedge-shaped letters in clay, you know, damp clay, and then it would get hard, and then you'd have a document that, you know, stands through time. That's very hard writing. And so to save time, the ancient people didn't use vowels. So imagine your name without vowels. So, for example, I'm Dave. Well, my name would be D-V. Well, all right. Well, that could be Dave. It could be Dive. It could be Dove. It could be Dove. And my middle name is Don. That would be D-N. No vowels. Well, D-N, that could be Dan, or done, or dove, or, all right, not done. We could have, I had a whole bunch of these in mind a moment ago. Dine, we could dine. What is DN? We don't know, without vowels. So they can see what was written, but there are no vowels. And then there were choices, like, how are we supposed to read this? So the first word was MN, mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Mene, but you don't have the E's. It just says MN for all intents and purposes. Well, mena is a measure of weight, like, you know, pounds or ounces. So mena is a measure of weight. But if it's mena with an H on the end, or mene, then that would mean that they are numbered. So which is it? Don't know. And then tekel would just be like, to us, TKL. Well, that's the same as the word shekel in Aramaic. And so that's also a measure of money, a measure of weight. It weighs this many shekels, you know, that idea. So it could mean shekel, or it could mean tekel. And if it's tekel, that means weighed. So which is it? Don't know. And then upharsin, or peres, either way, depending on how we form it in the language, that would just be like PS. Well, what is that supposed to mean? The PS could be upharsin, which means a half shekel. Okay, well, but it could also be broken in two, like the word, you know, broken in half. Or it could be related to the word Paris, which is the word for Persia. So without vowels, they don't know. Like, they can see the letters. The candle is lighting it up. It's on the wall there. Read it. Like, I don't know. Is it saying something about a certain thing being, for example, a mena plus a shekel and a half more? Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about Persia somehow? Like, what is this? They don't know. This was the handwriting on the wall. This was a breathtaking moment. It was a profoundly holy moment that has suddenly been visited upon some profoundly unholy people who are caught red-handed demeaning the true God of heaven. And so it is very troubling. Remember, even good Abraham, and he was good, even good Abraham, when he saw the vision of the Lord in the pillar of cloud walking between the divided animals, it says a horror of darkness, a terror of darkness fell upon him. That's good Abraham. If we're talking about Moses, Moses at Mount Sinai said, and so exceedingly fearsome was the sight that Moses says, I exceedingly fear and tremble. Good Moses trembled at Mount Sinai. Good Ezekiel, Daniel, and John, when they had a vision of God, they fell on their faces as dead. They were upset, troubled, frightened by what they saw. Good shepherds, at the Christmas event when the Christmas angels appeared, says they were sorely afraid. And they're good shepherds. And then if we're talking about good Peter, James, and John, the best disciples Jesus had, Peter, James, and John, who went up on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus and saw him transformed, it says that they were very afraid and fell on their faces. So they weren't even doing anything wrong. They were honoring the true God. And still, they were completely afraid. Now we have the handwriting on the wall, this holy moment brought in contact with holiness. And everybody involved in that feast was very, very frightened. And they deserved to be frightened. Once again, back on the Titanic, you know, the oh no moment when the truth begins to dawn. All right, well, Dr. Washington Dodge again. He says, as the lifeboats were being launched, many of the first cabin passengers expressed their preference of staying on the ship. Like, I'm just going to stay here. It won't sink, right? It's going to be underwater in 2 hours. I'm just going to stay here. But later, some of the passengers fought with such desperation to get into the lifeboats that the officers shot them and their bodies fell into the ocean. Now they're starting to get the idea. This ship is going to go down. Lewis Garrett was from Lebanon. So he and his sister didn't even speak English. He says, my sister was 14 years old and I was 12. What a sight. Most of the lifeboats were already gone. The crew was permitting women and children only to board the lifeboats. There were not enough for everyone. Amid this complete pandemonium and mass hysteria stood my sister and I, two immigrant children, unable to speak English, frightened beyond belief, crying and looking for help. Say, now we're getting it. Now we're in really big trouble. And we were on this, you know, great cruise, this great party, and suddenly it's over. And now the truth begins to dawn. Well, Belshazzar now has seen the handwriting on the wall, as we say, and the truth is beginning to dawn. He now moves to a desperate reach for some shred of hope. Like, oh no, I am enveloped in some sort of holy event here, and I am very afraid. Can this be salvaged somehow? And so he tries to salvage it. Chapter 5, verse 10. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you. You can salvage the situation. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your appearance be changed. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, I say your father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and fortune tellers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sayings and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Just bear in mind that we have two names in the air that are very similar. The king is Belshazzar. Daniel's pagan name was Belteshazzar. So almost the same. But if we say Belteshazzar, we're talking about Daniel. You see here, the queen comes in. Now, we think actually that the queen is probably the queen mother because Belshazzar's wives and concubines were already at the party. So now the queen comes in because she hears something of the news of what has taken place. And so we think that's actually the queen mother, maybe even the queen grandmother. You know, so this queen was probably not one of his wives. Nevertheless, we see that she has a tremendous grasp of history. And once again, that makes us think that she's an older woman because she says, what you have forgotten, son, is that your father and maybe grandfather, because remember, we use the term father for both, you know, natural father plus grandfather or even great-great-grandfathers, like the God of your fathers, you know, well, not just, you know, your immediate dad, but your grandfather and your grandfather before him. All right. So she has a grasp of this history and says, Belshazzar, your father, Nebuchadnezzar, really grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had this man, and you've forgotten, but he's really something. So you see, she knows about the old days. We think this is the queen mother and not one of the wives of Belshazzar. So, verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel, who's of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought out of Judah? I have also heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in you. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me so that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation of it. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you, that you can make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me the interpretation of it, you shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold around your neck, shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. So you see, we're grasping like, oh, Daniel, tell me that we're going to be okay. You know, the handwriting on the wall, we're going to be okay, right? Tell me. And the queen said, don't let your thoughts trouble you. Daniel will tell you. Well, Daniel does indeed tell. Back on the Titanic, Charlotte Collier is 31, and she's searching for some shred of hope when you realize that there really isn't much hope. She had been rescued and taken to New York, and she was hoping to run into her husband there. Somehow, maybe he had been rescued too. There was scarcely anyone who had not been separated from husband, child, or friend. I had a husband to search for, a husband whom in the greatness of my faith, I had believed would be found in one of the boats. He was not there. See, a shred of hope. Oh, maybe I'll find him. No, there is no shred of hope. Ellen, she says, we rowed away quickly, watching our ship slide beneath the surface of the water about 2:30 in the morning. The screams of those in the water were horrible. I remember calling over and over to her husband, Pecco, Pecco, I'm here. Come this way. Once aboard the Carpathia, which rescued those in the lifeboats, the passengers and crew did their best to console us. But with all we were given, I was still lacking. I remember standing at the railing for hours, looking out to the open sea and hoping upon hope that I would discover just one more lifeboat. And of course, it was not to be. You disrespect God, things finally begin to dawn on you that you're in trouble and you want to change. But then you realize that your last shreds of hope are going away. So his realization, Belshazzar's realization too late that he had indeed come to the end of the line. Chapter 5, verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself. I don't need a robe of scarlet. I don't need a chain of gold. Why don't you keep those things for yourself? And he would only have them for a couple of hours anyway. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father, your grandfather. Nabonidus comes after Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar after Nabonidus. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he killed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild burros. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomever he wishes. And you, his son, O Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart, though you knew all of this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drunk wine in them. And you've praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron, wood and stone, who do not see nor hear nor know. And the God in whose hand your breath is and whose are all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the part of the hand was sent from him, and this writing was written, and this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you are weighed in the balances and are found lacking. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar commanded, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet, put a chain of gold around his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler of the kingdom. In that night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was killed, and Darius the Mede took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. How could Daniel possibly be right? If you look on the left side of our slide here, you see a picture, our best guess of what Babylon looked like. Now, I know you can't see that very well, but you can see that there are two sides in the picture, the left side and the right side. The right side is what you might call Old Babylon. That's the most important side. That's where the king lives, and that's where the Great Pyramid is. And so that's on the right side. You see, then in the middle, there's the River Euphrates. And on the left side is what you might call the new city of Babylon. Now, that Euphrates River went right through the middle, and that meant that they have endless water. If you're going to besiege a city, what you have to do is cut them off so nobody can go out and nobody can come in. And then there won't be food. They'll run out of groceries. And the only way to get food is they have to go outside the city. Or if they don't run out of food first, they might run out of water. And they'll have to go outside the city to get water. But you're not going to let them go outside the city. And you're not going to let anybody come inside the city. And you're going to starve them out. And you're going to thirst them out. And they'll have to surrender. But if you have the Euphrates River going right through the middle of your town, you will never run out of water. To this day, the Euphrates River is drinkable. You will never run out of water. So they will never be thirsted out in this siege. And so Belshazzar says, we should have a feast. I don't care what the Persians are doing out there. We have endless water. Because we have endless water, we make little channels throughout the city and we water our gardens. We have gardens. We have plenty of food. We have grain stored up for years. And the Persians aren't going to hang around here for years and wait for us to get starved out. We may never starve out. And so how can we possibly fall? And Daniel says, oh, well, you're going to fall. How can Daniel be right? On the right-hand side, you see at the bottom of the slide, that's the Euphrates River. So this is kind of, you know, running sideways. We really need to tip the whole thing like the picture on the left so you can see what the Euphrates River is doing. So at the bottom, you see the green Euphrates River. And you might be able to see that there are some boats on the river. And then you see behind that the wall. But what you might not realize is that the wall is so wide that you can bring two chariots. Some people say four chariots. You can bring two wide chariots on the wall side by side and go all the way around. On the left-hand side, you see the wall, how it goes all the way around, both the new city and the old city, with the river in between. That wall is a double wall. So you have the first wall that's wide enough for two chariots to go on. And then you have the Euphrates River flooding a moat, a little 16-foot wide moat, and then another wall. So if you're going to conquer the city, you somehow have to get past the first wall, which you never will. And then you have to get past the second wall, which you never will. And then finally you can get to the people and you have to do hand-to-hand combat in the streets. But they're braced for that. So how could they possibly fall in one night? And the answer is they diverted the river. We know about this from historical sources, not even from the Bible. We know about this from Herodotus, Xenophon, Berosus, and a document called the Babylonian Chronicles, and another document from Cyrus is on what we call the Cyrus Cylinder. And it says, here's how they did it. The Persians diverted the water from the Euphrates River that flowed through the center of the city of Babylon into a lake nearby, thus lowering the water level so the soldiers could walk under the wall. So the river is in the city, and there are walls on each side of the river so nobody could just, you know, swim across and cause problems. But they lowered the river. And as Herodotus put it, the Persians entered the stream, which had now sunk so as to reach about midway up a man's thigh, and thus got into the town. They walked under the wall where the water used to flow, and so thus they got into the town. Had the Babylonians noticed their danger, they would never have allowed the Persians to enter the city, but would have destroyed them utterly. For mounting upon the walls along both sides of the stream, they would have caught the enemy as it were in a trap. But as it was, the Persians came upon them by surprise and took the city. The inhabitants of the central parts knew nothing of what had chanced as they were engaged in a festival. And so that very night, Belshazzar died. Back to the Titanic. The wife of Dr. Washington Dodge described what it was like. Remember, women and children first, right, in the lifeboat, so they're pulling away. And she remembers the awful scene of the great steamer, Titanic, as we drew away. From the upper rails, heroic husbands and fathers were waving and throwing kisses to their women folk in the receding lifeboats. And most of the people on the Titanic died. About two-thirds of them died. So the realization too late that he had come to the end of the line. And this is the great lesson of human accountability that we find in Daniel chapter 5. This is such an extraordinary, you know, spellbinding story when you realize that it's not just fiction. This actually happened. The entire, you know, handwriting on the wall. This would be like you seeing a ghost. It's just a phenomenal thing to imagine. And the holy hush that settles on everybody. And Daniel coming in and saying, you are in trouble now with the great God that you have been mocking at this very party. You were in trouble. And the realization too late that the end of the line was here. This is a great lesson for all of us. To outside observers, you know, which we all are, but especially in those days, to outside observers, Belshazzar must have looked like he had the world all figured out. You know, you just feel like that sometimes, like, boy, that guy really has everything figured out, right? Here's Belshazzar. He is the king of the world's only superpower. And he has everything all figured out, doesn't he? I mean, you look at this city of Babylon, you look at the grain stores, you look at the great pyramid to his god, which was a temple at the top, a platform to meet the evil spirits. You look at the prosperity, you look at the power, whomever I want, I kill, whomever I want, I promote, whatever I want. And you think, wow, that guy really has the world by the tail. He has the world all figured out, doesn't he? Until that, oh no, moment when suddenly, as if he had seen a ghost, we have the handwriting on the wall. Daniel was just the opposite. Imagine being Daniel. When Daniel went into captivity as just a teenager, he was Babylon's beaten and humiliated whipping dog. Imagine. You get hauled off to Babylon. They castrate you. They tell you this is what you're going to do from now on. Nobody that you love is around you. He was Babylon's whipping dog. But now, at the feast, they bring in Daniel. They're going to give him a scarlet robe and a gold chain, probably even a gold collar. And right now, you know what he is? He's not Babylon's whipping dog. He's the man in charge. And everybody knows it. These two individuals, the great superpower king, pagan influencer, and Daniel, are in exactly opposite trajectories. One is on his way down, will be killed in a couple of hours. And one is being promoted in the kingdom. What a strange way to have these two lives change so suddenly. Role reversal. We have this saying around, you know, Christian circles. We say payday someday. Sure, you can get away with it for a long, long time. But payday someday. You can count on that. God is not going to be mocked. Whatever a man plants, he harvests. And that's just the way it's going to be. So we have two different conclusions, depending on who we're talking about. If it's Belshazzar, the king, then Daniel 5 is the thrilling true story about a powerful pagan influencer, we'd call him today, who intentionally disrespected God all his life in a very public way until the last day of his life. And he seemed to get away with it. But then, only a few hours before he died, because he died that same night as the party, he's brought face to face with a kind of holiness and majesty that he had never even imagined before when he was worshiping his demon gods. And that majesty and holiness was one that he had been mocking earlier that very same day. And then it was too late for him to change, too late for him to undo the choices he'd made in his life. That's the first story, the first conclusion, the first biography. Second conclusion, Daniel 5 is a thrilling story about another person. A faithful kid whose childhood dreams of marriage and parenting and a lifetime of warm memories with Israelite friends and neighbors were all crushed by a brutal war loss. That's Daniel. Then he was hauled off and forced to live in a place where everything he loved, everything he enjoyed, was either missing or mocked or stamped out entirely. That's Daniel, living in a pagan environment. And then it's also the story of a kid who grew up to show the world, the whole world, maybe as no other mortal man has ever done, to show the whole world in good times and bad times that God rules in the affairs of man. And whoever believes in him shall not be ashamed. Not at the end. If you decide to follow the Lord through the bad times as well as the good times, you're going to come to eventually the end of your life story. And the scripture says repeatedly, whosoever believes on him shall not be ashamed. You're not going to come to the end of your life with regrets and humiliation. Whoever believes on him is not going to be ashamed in the end. But if you reject him, you are going to have deep regrets, humiliation. You're going to find out how terribly wrong you were. Whoever believes on him shall not be ashamed. So, the most powerful pagan influencer in the world did not measure up in God's courtroom. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Your days are numbered. This is it. You've been weighed in the balance and you've been found wanting. And now you're going to lose the kingdom. So the most powerful pagan influencer in the world who mocked God and got away with it is now suddenly realizing that he doesn't measure up in God's courtroom. But Daniel sure did. So be a Daniel.